And now, the CEO of the National Biodiesel Board, Joe Jobe.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Hey, we got a great crowd out there. Any Giants fans out there by any chance? A couple of them. Yeah, I was going to start out with a Super Bowl joke, but there was absolutely nothing funny about that game last night. I saw Stephen Levy, who I think he came from the game. I saw him backstage. I said, give me some material. He goes, hey, that was all business. There's nothing to joke about that Super Bowl. So I'll skip that. You know, I've always believed that a good story was often the most compelling way to make a point. So I thought I'd start out this morning by sharing with you a very personal testimonial about what biodiesel means to me and how I became interested in energy politics and history. The story starts in 1979. So let me set the stage for you just a little bit with some pictures from that era. This is my family farm that I grew up on. We raised cattle. It was a beautiful place to grow up. I had woods and creeks. It gave me a deep appreciation for nature and land stewardship and hard work. When I look at this picture, a couple of things always make me chuckle. Do you see that big yellow thing there in the middle of the picture in the yard? Anybody guess what that is? The slip and slide. You know what I'm talking about. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a hydro-powered recreational device called a slip and slide. And there under the light pole, you can just barely see a couple knuckleheads playing basketball and waving at the plane that's taking this picture. That's my brother and I. 1979 was the year that I got hit in the head with a baseball. Gave me a huge black eye, which I thought made me look pretty tough for the ladies. I also got my first guitar for Christmas in 1979. I was very excited about that. This is the only picture I could find of that first guitar. That's my mom and brothers and cousins. Fine-looking bunch, don't you think? I'm the middle shirtless one, holding the dog in one hand and the guitar in the other. So 1979 was a big year for me. I was a very formative age, and something else happened that year that had a very profound effect on the way that I viewed the world. 79 was the year the Iran hostage crisis began. I watched the news almost every night of Iranians burning American flags, calling for death to America, humiliating our hostages. I watched the Ayatollah Khomeini praising this act of terrorism. Our class made yellow ribbons. We counted the days till our hostages were released or rescued. 79 was also the year that the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan during the height of the Cold War in a move that put them within 300 miles of the Strait of Hormuz. In his State of the Union address in 1980, President Carter laid out what remains current U.S. policy today, became known as the Carter Doctrine, which is, if anyone tries to block the flow of oil through the Strait of Hormuz, America will go to war. A very plain message. I also remember the gasoline lines in 79 and 80, caused primarily by the U.S. embargo of Iranian oil. And I worried that I wouldn't get to drive a car when I turned 16. Well, I did get to drive my own car when I turned 16. It was a 78 Plymouth Volare, arguably one of the ugliest cars ever made. But you know what? That didn't bother me a bit. I put a cassette deck in it, Roadmaster speakers. I had tunes. I had wheels. I was rolling. When I looked at that car, let me tell you something. I didn't see a Plymouth Volare. I saw freedom, baby. I remember filling it up one day. I was doing the math in my head. Gasoline had jumped to $1.21 a gallon. And I was adding it up. It cost me $30 to fill up. I had a job that paid $3 an hour, so it took more than a day's pay to fill up my car. I wrote a paper for my high school economics class about developing a market for ag-based fuels to supplement our energy supply. Now, I know what you're thinking. No, he didn't. He's just making that up for effect. Promise. Job's honor. I really did. It's a true story. I had vaguely heard about biofuels, and it just seemed obvious. Got a B- on the paper, by the way, which probably was generous because I did almost no research. I just relied on simple observations. The mid-80s were terrible for little farming communities like ours. I personally know of families who lost their farms. So why were we getting into conflicts in the Middle East, continuing to buy oil from people who hated us, when our struggling farmers could do more to grow more fuels here, right here on our own. So my paper was overly simplistic and naive, but after working in this industry for almost 15 years now, the basic idea is clearer than ever, and it's now become a reality. Over the past four decades, America has not had a consistent and clear energy policy. Our energy policy has primarily been carried out through our foreign policy and our military policy. That is, to protect our strategic interests in oil, primarily in the Persian Gulf region. That's clearly not worked, because after conflicts in Iran, Libya, Lebanon, Libya again, Afghanistan, Libya again, Iran, Iraq, Iraq again, and Libya again, here we are, back in a battle of brinksmanship with Iran over increased sanctions for their oil exports. Now, granted, not all of these conflicts or actions are all about oil, but no one can deny that oil is a significant factor in U.S. involvement in the region. Now, if the prospect of a military conflict with Iran doesn't give you pause, consider this. We just finished the longest and the second most expensive war, second to the World War II, in U.S. history, in Iraq. Iran is three times larger than Iraq. They're supported by their nuclear allies in Russia and China, and they're on track to go nuclear themselves within a few years. Iran is richer than ever from its oil exports because of high sustained crude oil prices over the last decade. And as the world's largest consumer of oil, that's us, we just participated in the wrong end of the biggest transfer of wealth in human history. After buying crude oil at mini bar prices and fighting three wars in the last decade, is it any surprise that America is broke? The situation is so bad that our current president has ordered the dropping of more bombs in his first term as commander-in-chief than any Nobel Peace Prize winner in history. Thank you for laughing at that. Now, oil is the lifeblood of modern industry, and it has brought prosperity. And let me be very clear, this is not, repeat, not an anti-petroleum industry speech. On the contrary, our partners in the North American petroleum industry are our customers. Without them, we don't have infrastructure, distribution, or much of a market at all. And the North American petroleum industry has been a good partner with the North American biodiesel industry. We have a proven track record of working to solve problems together. Indeed, that's why we're going to have some of those petroleum partners join me in a conversation here in a moment. We need to develop all sources of domestic energy, including hydrocarbons. But a continued singular reliance on crude oil in our transportation sector clearly makes us poorer, weaker, and less safe. And the only way to change that is through sound energy policy, not just foreign policy. That brings us to the Renewable Fuel Standard. 2011 saw one of the most dramatic comebacks of an industry in recent memory. After production volumes dropped by more than half over the last 2 years, this industry hung in there, pulled itself up to over 300% growth in a single year, our first 1 billion gallon year ever. And in an otherwise sluggish economy, the biodiesel industry was a bright spot, adding more than 25,000 jobs and billions of dollars of economic activity to the economy. Now, while the downturn of the biodiesel industry in 2009 and 2010 was painful, in some ways, it made our industry stronger, more competitive, more prepared for the future. We're battle-tested and ready and wiser to meet what we're facing going forward. 2011 was nothing short of a transformation for our industry and a modest yet sensible turning point for U.S. energy policy. The extension of the biodiesel tax credit was a big part of last year's success. We're going to talk about the tax credit more in the panel later and also tomorrow. This morning, I want to talk about and focus on the Renewable Fuel Standard. The RFS demonstrated last year that effective energy policy can be carried out by actual energy policy. After the first year of implementation, it has its wrinkles to iron out, and we're going to talk about those in depth, especially rent integrity. But 2011 demonstrated that the RFS can work at doing what Congress intended, which is to draw renewable fuels into the market, and it has done that. I want to commend the EPA for their work in bringing this program together. They've had a very difficult job in taking this complex new law, a wide range of stakeholders, and building a workable program. The RFS has created, for the first time, a clear, predictable, stable, and sustainable future for this industry. It's a piece of policy that will allow us to grow conservatively over time if we do this right. It won't guarantee everyone in biodiesel a place in the market, but it will stimulate competitiveness and innovation. It'll attract investment in technology and plant science and all manner of efficiencies as the industry matures. It allows us to work with our partners in renewable diesel to develop new markets, such as biojet. Most of all, 2011 demonstrated that the RFS works and the U.S. biodiesel industry has turned a corner in a very transformational way. Malcolm Gladwell has a great book called The Tipping Point. The book is about how little changes can start off slowly and then tip very quickly for big effects. That's exactly what we saw in the biodiesel industry last year. Next year, NBB will be 20 years old. It took 15 years of regulatory, technical, and education battles to get this fuel to commercialization. But clearly, the tipping point came in 2011 as the industry transformed with the changes caused by the RFS. One of the best examples in the book of the tipping point phenomenon is the show Sesame Street. The creators of Sesame Street had a goal in the 60s of using TV to improve learning skills to prepare children for school. The prevailing academic view was that TV was an idiot box that prevented learning. The creators were determined, despite being dismissed by the experts. They brought in some of the most creative minds of the time, like Jim Henson and Frank Oz. They borrowed techniques from TV commercials to teach kids about numbers. And the extraordinary thing is, it worked. And that's how we got Cookie Monster, Bert and Ernie, Oscar, you know, all the greats. The show debuted the same week as the moon landing, so it didn't get a lot of attention at first. And when it did get attention, it was panned as a hippie radical boondoggle. It was even banned in the state of Mississippi because they said children weren't ready for Sesame Street's integrated cast. Yeah, boo. But creators were smart, persistent, committed to innovation. And this little children's show actually accomplished what it set out to accomplish. Piles of academic studies have proven that Sesame Street increases the learning skills of its viewers. It's inspirational to imagine how many children's lives have been changed by this one little idea that wouldn't quit. And here's something else that's cool about Sesame Street. They use bioheat. Now, biodiesel is like Sesame Street in that we certainly have plenty of colorful characters. I'm not saying who, but we have a few Oscars. We also have some of the most energetic and talented people in the area of research, policy, communications, and manufacturing. We're committed to the goal of bringing this high-quality, high-performance, renewable fuel to the market along with all of the benefits that it brings to our country. And we're committed to innovation and competitiveness. 2011 should be remembered as the year we reached our tipping point and ended all doubt about whether biodiesel will be an important part of our nation's energy supply. Now, we still have some big challenges, but if there's one thing that we've learned and proven to ourselves is that we can take on big challenges and win. One of our challenges is that we must recognize the transformational tipping point that we just experienced and transform our thinking accordingly. The RFS is an incredibly powerful piece of energy policy that we know works, but we also know that it's still new and it's vulnerable to attack. If we learned anything from our recent struggles, it's that we can't take policy for granted. We have to be absolutely committed to the success and protection of the RFS as our top priority. From NBB's perspective, that means everything we do, all of the resources at our disposal need to be deployed in a way that is supportive of that objective. whether that's our government affairs program, communications, technical, sustainability, fuel quality, or other programs. It includes the extension of the tax credit, which reduces RFS compliance costs and stimulates investment in infrastructure. To the individual members of this industry, it means we have to recommit to grassroots advocacy and demonstrate leadership in key areas. What are those areas? First of all, RIN integrity. Now, we all know by now that there have been two cases of RIN fraud that created invalid RINs in the system. First, we want to commend the EPA Enforcement Division and the Secret Service for taking RIN fraud seriously and putting measures in place to stop it. As unseemly as the enforcement actions are, it's necessary to send a clear message to criminals that if they commit RIN fraud, they'll go to jail. RIN fraud's not a victimless crime. Obligated parties were harmed significantly because they ultimately ended up with the worthless RINs. But in talking to them, what they're most upset about is that the fraud committed against them caused them to be served with notices of violation, or NOVs, and fines. So from their perspective, they were not only out the money for the bad RINs and out the money for the fines, they're most upset about being deemed as violators because of the fraud that was perpetrated against them. Now, this is reasonable. This is a justifiable frustration. And we're certainly sympathetic to that. It does seem that the EPA has been appropriately flexible in working with the obligated parties and trying to get these issues resolved in this first year. Biodiesel producers were harmed because many medium and small plants have been unable to monetize the value of their RINs because of the uncertainty that these cases caused. NBB is fully committed to addressing this issue head on. Our chairman, Gary Hare, is appointing a RIN integrity task force that will be co-chaired by him and a representative of an obligated party. We have obligated parties, blenders, producers, and the EPA that have already committed to serving on this task force. We're committed to finding solutions to prevent any further fraud from the system, and I am personally taking a lead in staffing this effort along with our chairman. Prior to working for NBB, I was a criminal fraud investigator. I trained at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Glencoe, Georgia, which is where the Secret Service agents train, like the ones who investigated the RIN fraud. In fact, there were a couple of Secret Service agents in my fraud certification course. And I hung out with those guys in the evenings, along with a couple of ATF agents who had just come from the raid in Waco just a year before. I asked the Secret Service guys to tell me stories about guarding the president. Surely there's some really interesting stories about that, right? Well, I was surprised to learn that they didn't have very many. And that's when I learned that the Secret Service wasn't originally formed for presidential protection. They were formed by President Lincoln, ironically, to bust counterfeiters. Prior to Lincoln, there was no national currency. It was all in the form of individually issued state banknotes. And it was estimated that as much as one-third of the notes in circulation were counterfeit. So Lincoln formed the National Bank and the Secret Service to fight the counterfeiting. So fraud and counterfeiting is certainly nothing new for the Secret Service. They managed to deal with it in the late 1800s for the whole system of currency. And we will deal with RIN integrity in this relatively small RIN program. But it's going to take a unified effort, and we call on our partners in the petroleum industry to join us in this effort. Now, opponents of the RFS will use any flaw to characterize it as a failed program. But it's not a failed program. It's working, and we have to make it work better. Opponents have effectively mobilized, and they have some sympathetic ears in Congress. Here's their main argument. Alternative fuels should stand on their own in the free market, unfettered by the interference of energy policy. That really sounds great. And look, I'm a fan of free market capitalism. But the truth is, there is nothing unfettered about the energy markets. They are what you might call fettered. People seem to forget or choose to ignore this very unfortunate fact. Global oil production, markets, supplies, prices are manipulated by a cartel called OPEC, whose members read like a who's who of state-supported terrorism. OPEC's goal is to keep prices artificially inflated over the long haul with intermittent sudden price drops to eliminate emerging alternatives. Cartels are illegal in almost all nations. As a CEO of a U.S. trade association, I would go to jail if I tried to manipulate prices or supplies in the biodiesel industry. Now, cartels are not just illegal under U.S. law, they're illegal, in fact, under international law. The WTO outlaws conspiracies to fix markets and allows member nations to prosecute any parties to the conspiracy. This is the best example of why foreign policy as the primary means to carry out energy policy fails. We can't take action against OPEC at the WTO because the only OPEC member nations who are also WTO member nations are the only countries, OPEC countries, that we have diplomatic relationships with, such as Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, Nigeria. And the primary remedy under a U.S. action by the WTO would be to force those countries to either leave OPEC or leave the WTO. And this would certainly, almost certainly, end diplomatic relations with virtually the only oil exporting countries with whom we have diplomatic relations. So we don't dare do it because it's counter to our foreign policy while leaving us completely resigned to continue suffering the antics of OPEC. Now, we know that OPEC is not the only factor that impacts crude prices. Growing demand in China and India, politics in the Middle East region, they also impact prices. If Iran makes good on its threat to shut down the Strait of Hormuz, through which one-fifth of the world's oil flows every day, it would undoubtedly have a devastating impact on the global economy and would send America to war with Iran. But here's the thing. Iran doesn't even need to shut down the straits and risk war in order to launch an attack on our economy. Iran has approximately 5% of the world's oil production capacity. According to Economist magazine, supply disruptions of that magnitude in the past have been associated with 20 to 70% price spikes. With that kind of market power, Iran could simply, they could send America back into a deep recession just by shutting down their own production for a few months. As the Economist magazine puts it, the United States paid about $125 billion more for oil imports in 2011 than it did in 2010 because of the unrest in the Middle East region. That oil tax was essentially enough to wipe out the entire stimulative effect of last year's tax cut deal. A similar oil spike this year would cancel out a hefty chunk of the benefits of extending the $200 billion payroll tax cut bill that Congress is fighting over right now. We have an immediate challenge that we have to participate in right now, and that is the EPA's rulemaking concerning 2013 RFS volumes. The Office of Management and Budget postponed the approval of the 2013 RFS volumes for the biomass-based diesel category until February. The EPA had proposed increasing the 2013 volumes above the statutory minimums to 1.28 billion gallons in 2013. This is a modest growth rate that's supported by very sound agronomic and economic data. Our industry must be allowed to have conservative growth under the RFS or we will stagnate. Lack of growth would eliminate opportunities for innovation and competition and investment and all the promise the RFS brings that we know our industry is capable of. We already exceeded a billion gallons in 2011. We're set for a billion gallons in 2012. If not raised for 2013, it will hold us flat for 3 years in a row. But more importantly than that, if we lose this fight, it will set a precedent that will make it even more difficult to grow volumes beyond 2013. We have to make our leaders understand the importance of this issue. We've initiated a grassroots outreach campaign, and we're going to talk about that in more detail tomorrow. Here is our call to action for today. Please go to the NBB booth, sign letters to your members of Congress and the administration. I beg you to take this seriously. This is perhaps the most immediate threat facing the long-term future of this industry. I'm going to conclude by reiterating my main message. In the President's State of the Union address 2 weeks ago, he called for an all-of-the-above strategy to increase our domestic energy supply. I agree with that concept. We need to develop a comprehensive energy strategy that increases our supply of all sources of domestic energy, including hydrocarbons. Having said that, because petroleum is a global commodity and its prices are impacted by outside forces, we also have to diversify our energy portfolio. It's just like an investment portfolio. If it's not diversified, it's weak and vulnerable. If we continue using primarily one source of transportation fuel, American energy consumers will continue to be taxed by OPEC and our enemies. We could become completely self-sufficient with domestic petroleum, and that would still be the case. We have to embrace a strong, comprehensive energy strategy that includes more domestic petroleum, coupled with diversification, and work with our partners in the North American petroleum industry to implement that strategy. The RFS is a good start. We've proven that it works. Now our task is to make it work even better. So I started my little talk this morning by saying that I wanted to tell you what biodiesel means to me. So let me put it this way. When I drive home at night in my American-made truck, running on a blend of American-made biodiesel from materials grown by America's farmers, biodiesel is to me freedom. Sort of like that 78 Plymouth was to me at 16. It wasn't a perfect car, but it was a good car. And most importantly, it was my car. And that felt a lot like freedom to me. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening.